Welcome to the spring broadcast of Echolocation. I'm Elizabeth Lojudis, and I'll be taking you on a sonic journey, exploring natural soundscapes and the electromagnetic field. Tonight's show is called Animal Magnetism, and we'll be experiencing magnetic vibrations of amorous frogs who sing songs to attract a mate. We'll explore the magnetic migration of intrepid travelers who use the Earth's magnetic field to find their way home. And we'll discover magnetic levitations and hear the astounding story of a floating frog. On the winter broadcast of this show, we focused on the human animal, and we'll revisit some of the ways our species is impacting the natural soundscape, particularly through climate change. And in the second hour of the show, we'll hear the Seattle Symphony Orchestra perform Become Ocean, which is John Luther Adams' musical composition about sea level rise in its entirety. Right. Well, spring has sprung and we're being serenaded by amphibian love songs. We think of the returning dawn chorus of birds as a harbinger of spring, but frog calls also celebrate winter's end. A group of birds is called a flock, but a group of frogs is called an army. We're also hearing the calls of spring peepers, one of the first sounds of spring in our region. Spring peepers are tiny frogs that are barely larger than your fingernail, but they sure can make a racket when they're looking for action. American toads join the peepers later in the spring. Their love song is a melodic trill that fills the nighttime soundscape with strange overtones and slightly discordant harmonies. Another trill joins the chorus. It's the song of the tree frog, which often comes from above the listener. Tree frogs don't hop much. They're climbers with toes like sticky adhesive pads. They live high in trees and descend only at night. You know what I'm talking. As the days lengthen and the temperatures warm, green frogs begin to sing in ponds. Like all frogs, green frogs have well-developed ears on each side of their head with a very conspicuous tympanum, or eardrum, which is specialized tissue that vibrates when hit by sound waves. We're going to be talking more about tympanum on this show, mainly because I like the sound of the word tympanum.
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 When summer is nearly upon us, the bullfrogs begin their love songs. Some people think it sounds like they are saying, "Jug-a-rum." But I'm not quite sure. They might just be saying tympanum.
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 Tintinum.
So in honor of all those amorous frogs out there, here's a song by Marvin Gaye.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Whoa, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas. Fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby Baba's lives. Mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more be used from man? Can't you stand that?
Just heard Marvin Gaye's 1971 song, The Ecology, which recognizes human impacts on the interconnected world. Indeed, everything is interconnected, not only through obvious processes like the food web, but also in other less visible ways. For example, many types of animals have a magnetic sense and use the Earth's magnetic field to orient them during migration, using a sense that's called magnetoreception. The frenzied frogs in my neighborhood might have love on their minds, but they use magnetoreception to migrate to the watering hole. Migratory birds use magnetoreception, as do migratory fish, like the American eel, which travels thousands of miles to complete its life cycle. Dolphins have been shown to have the ability of magnetoreception, and foxes use the Earth's magnetic field for orientation when hunting prey in the wintertime. Bats use echolocation for short-range navigation, but they may use magnetoreception for long-distance travel. And insects, such as butterflies and bees and even bacteria, have been shown to use the Earth's magnetic field for orientation. Humans haven't yet proven to have a magnetic sense, but that hasn't stopped us from messing around with magnetism. A 1997 article in New Scientist magazine describes how a research team from universities in England and the Netherlands created a giant magnetic field to make a frog float in the air. And quoting from the article, "The levitation trick works because giant magnetic fields slightly distort the orbits of electrons in the frog's atoms. The resulting electric current generates a magnetic field in the opposite direction of that of the magnet. Many materials are diamagnetic. That is, when placed near a magnet, their atoms fight the magnetic field and the object tries to scoot away. If such a material is placed in a strong enough magnetic field, it levitates. All materials are diamagnetic to some extent, but some are more convenient to levitate than others. Frogs, apparently, are convenient because they have a high water content, which is a good diamagnetic material, but also because they fit easily inside a tube-shaped bitter electromagnet. Bitter electromagnets use a very large electric current to create an extremely strong magnetic field, which magnetizes the frog, and when it is pushed from a region of high magnetic field into one of lower magnetic field, the frog levitates." Well, frog levitation is a new one on me, but if you care to see a video of a levitating frog that apparently was not hurt by the process, you can visit the echolocation page at facebook.com/echolocationWGXC. You're listening to Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM, hands-on community radio for Greene and Columbia counties. Or perhaps you're listening on Wavefarm Radio at wavefarm.org. However you're tuning in, thank you for listening. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lo Judas, and we just heard a song called Frogs, which is off of an album entitled Magnified, which seemed appropriate enough after hearing about levitating amphibians. The song is by a band called Failure. Well, it's that time again. It's time for the Echolocator Profile. Edition, we have a surprise because we're not just gonna investigate an echolocator. We're gonna take a closer gander at their prey. Insects and bats both hear at ultrasonic levels, and they've evolved together in a predator-prey relationship, adapting to each other's techniques and defenses. Insects have tympanal organs that consist of the tympanum, and internal air sacs called the trachea. The tympanal organs respond to a wide band of frequencies extending well into the ultrasonic range. Many insects produce high-frequency sound for communication with each other, but they can also hear bats' echolocation clicks and react defensively. Insects have ears all over their bodies. Crickets have ears on their legs, tiger beetles have ears on their abdomens, some butterflies have ears on their wings, and some moths have ears on their thorax. Some insects can hear the bat's ultrasonic pulses as it hunts, and they react by taking evasive maneuvers. Some crickets will dive when they hear bat-like sounds, and praying mantids react to bat sounds with dives and spiral flight. But beyond defensive behavior like diving for cover, some insects will try to deflect or jam bat echolocation signals. Tiger beetles and some kinds of moths, including tiger moths, produce ultrasonic clicking sounds from the tympanum when they hear bat signals. Some tiger moths produce long trains of clicks at high rates, and it's been hypothesized that the clicks of tiger moths could function as an acoustical camouflage by simulating multiple targets and creating false echoes near the moth to jam the bat's biosonar. Some bats and insects actually share the same hibernicula, and marauding bats feed on hibernating insects. And so the nymphalid butterflies have evolved a defense in which they can detect the vibration of a bat crawling towards them in the dark. And the butterfly reacts by opening its wings in a manner that produces intense ultrasonic clicks from a special area of the wing membrane. And the clicks may startle bats, or they might interfere with the bat's biosonar system, or they could warn bats of a distasteful prey. But the bats get startled, that's for sure. And bats evolve trying to adapt to the defense mechanisms of these insects. They may adapt by using higher or lower frequency ranges in an attempt to echolocate outside their prey's hearing range, or they may attempt to click more quietly, whisper click, I guess, to avoid detection. So on this broadcast, we salute the intrepid insects that jam bat signals, tiger moths, tiger beetles, nymphalid butterflies, and their kin. all night flying, deep listening, ultrasonic clicking, echolocation saboteurs whose bodies are covered in ears.
She said, I can be a frog. I can be a bat. I can be a bear. Or I can be a cat. She said, I can be a lion. I can be a Gila monster.
Thanks for tuning in to Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM, hands-on community radio for Greene and Columbia counties, or online at wavefarm.org. We just heard the song I Can Be a Frog by the Flaming Lips off of their album Embryonic. This is a segment that I call News from the Sounding Board, which features updates from the world of sound. The weather really has been strange so far this spring, with temperature swings and torrential rains. So in this edition, I'm focusing on the sound of climate change. My first story is from the website Discovery of Sound in the Sea, which features a page that describes how sonar is being used to help track the rise in ocean temperatures. While we know that ocean temperatures are rising, it's difficult to measure because the ocean is so large and it's not uniformly the same temperature. Deploying enough thermometers to precisely collect data in the oceans all over the world is just impossible. But using sound as a measure is an alternative approach that works. Very precise measurements of average temperatures can be made with sound, and this is because in warmer water, sound travels faster. By measuring the travel time of sound between two points, the average temperature of the water between those points can be determined. So this technique provides the large-scale average temperatures needed to study climate change. It's pretty cool. And while humans are measuring rising ocean temperatures with sound, climate change is already altering the marine landscape. a recently released TEDx talk by Dr. Kate Stafford, an oceanographer and professor at University of Washington, describes the changes in the Arctic underwater soundscape that are associated with melting ice sheets. And she describes the Arctic underwater soundscape as full of the calls of whales, seals, walruses, and the sound of the ice itself. Animals navigate and communicate in this dark world using sound. And under the heavy ice in winter, the Arctic has some of the lowest ambient noise levels in the world's oceans. But as Stafford explains, as sea ice decreases, the underwater soundscape is changing as subarctic species move north and compete with Arctic species for food and habitat. With more open water, humans are also invading in cruise ships and oil rigs, filling the once pristine soundscape with engine noise and air guns. If you'd like to watch Dr. Stafford's TEDx talk, a link can be found on the Echolocation Facebook page. On our last show, we featured an interview with some other faculty members from the University of Washington, Dr. Dargan Frierson and Judy Tweet from the Atmospheric Sciences Department. And they have sonified data tracking the rise in the Earth's temperature overall, as well as the rise in atmospheric concentration of CO2. Today, I'm going to share another example of sonification that's being used to interpret the impact of climate change. This story was featured in a September 2016 article in The Atlantic by Michelle Njuis. It describes the efforts of ecologist Lauren Oakes, who's studying the widespread death of yellow cedar trees in southeast Alaska. Ancient forests of yellow cedar are dying as shrinking snow cover exposes this tree's shallow roots to freezing temperatures. Oakes collaborated with a fellow Stanford University PhD student, Nick Saw, to translate the decline in forest diversity into song. Different instruments in the piece represent different species of trees. The yellow cedars are represented by the piano. Each note represents an individual tree, and its pitch and how hard it's hit corresponds with the tree's height and diameter. Lower, shorter notes stand for younger trees, while higher, longer notes stand for older ones. And quoting from the article, dead trees are represented by dropped notes. Gaps in the piano widen as the sonification moves from the cooler study plots in the north to the warmer plots in the south. So let's listen to the piece, which is entitled Forest Changes in the Alexander Archipelago. Thank you. The Atlantic article also features what they call a yellow cedar species solo. And when you hear the piano without the accompanying instruments, the silence that illustrates the loss of the yellow cedar is heard much more dramatically. You're listening to Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM, hands-on community radio for Green and Columbia counties. Soundscape ecologist Bernie Krause has been recording bioacoustics for over 40 years, and he is sounding the alarm about how climate change is causing impacts to wildlife and natural acoustics worldwide. And we'll listen to an excerpt of a recent interview with Krause that was featured on Derek Jensen's Resistance Radio, which aired on April 23rd on the Progressive Radio Network, which can be found at prn.fm.
Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Bernie Krause. He's an American musician and soundscape ecologist. In 1968, he founded Wild Sanctuary, an organization dedicated to the recording and archiving of natural soundscapes. Krause is an author, a bioacoustician, a speaker, and natural sound artist. He helped define the field of study of soundscape ecology. So, first off, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, you're very welcome, Derek.
Over the decades, so many people have written to me, and I'm sure the same thing has happened to you, to say, I don't hear the sounds I used to hear. And a great example right here is every March and April where I live now. I live in far northern California. 17 years ago when I first moved here, the tree frogs were so loud at night that you could not hold a human conversation outside at night. It was too loud to hear each other. And every spring now I wonder, is this a spring I won't hear any? Because they've gotten less and less loud until now you can easily stand outside and you'll hear two or three frogs, which is very different than hearing 200 or 300.
Yeah, or thousands. The frogs here have come back. And there was a period from around 2011 to 2015 that we heard hardly any. And that was really at the height of the California drought, which was historically the worst drought that's occurred in 1,200 years. So it was a serious one. As a matter of fact, a place that I'd been recording, a place called Sugarloaf State Park, I'm just south of you, about a five-hour drive, and in Sonoma Valley. And there's a ridge of hills, sometimes they call them mountains, that divides Sonoma and Napa Valleys. And I've been recording at that at a place called Sugarloaf State Park, which is on that ridge. And in 2015, it was the first silent spring I've ever experienced in my life. I've been recording there for 20 years, and since we moved to this valley, and I can tell you that it was one of the most shocking experiences of my life to see birds. I mean, there were birds certainly, but none of them were singing. It was absolutely dead silent. So if you can imagine that and kind of extrapolate, you know, where we might be headed with this, it's pretty dystopian.
On your website for the Wild Sanctuary Wild Sanctuary, you mention at one point beautiful soundscapes, and I'm not going to ask you to choose one because I can't do that myself either. But what are some of the most moving to you soundscapes that you have recorded, or soundscapes that you wish that everyone could hear?
That's an unfair question at all. It's a great question. And my favorite place to record has always been Alaska. Alaska, because in a state about a third the size of the whole United Lower 48, there are only 500,000 people there, no, 700,000 now, a little over 700,000. And you can get away, you can get far away from human encounters for long periods of time. There are always planes flying over, you know, occasionally you'll see one or two planes a day, but you're a long way away from things. And you can get out to places where there's still no development. That said, places like the Yukon Delta, for instance, and it's one of my favorite albums because it's so rich and beautiful and lyrical, like you say, like a symphony. The problem is that the tundra is melting all over Alaska now. When we went to the Arctic Refuge to record in 2006, we had identified 21 places where we wanted from which we were going to choose before we took the three teams and set them up in different places. And we got there June 1st to Fairbanks. And when we began to talk to U.S. Fish and Wildlife guys, this game warden was really on top of things and helping us out. We were told that 18 of those 21 places, the tundra was too soft. June 1st, the tundra was too soft to land, so we couldn't get to them. And the three places that we got to, it was clear that even at that time of year, which usually doesn't happen until mid-June or late June, already the tundra was beginning to melt to the point where what we were seeing was robins, American robins, 300 miles further north than they had ever been seen or heard before. And the Native Americans who were living in some of the very small villages in that area didn't even have a name for the bird because they'd never seen it before. So we're seeing and hearing things that are changing so rapidly now.
We've talked some about the effects of this diminishing soundscape on humans. What, in your experience, what are the effects? How does, if we drop off non-sonic habitat loss, because now I'm counting, thanks to you, I'm counting the soundscape as part of habitat. If we drop off
it's the
problems,
voice, it's the voice of the natural world.
And what happens to the natural world as that voice is diminished? What cascading effects does that have on the non-humans themselves as they are drowned out by machines, basically?
Well, they don't even have to be drowned out by machines. When you do a clear cut or you do selective logging, for instance, it has a profound effect on the biophony. And when one creature that's helped serve as an underpinning for the biophony in that particular habitat is lost, all of the other creatures fall into a chaotic way of expressing themselves. Because that gap is missing, and that underpinning that was so important to the whole biophony is missing, so they struggle for sometimes long periods of time, sometimes decades, to find that balance again, that bioacoustic balance that is so necessary to maintain the integrity, certainly the bioacoustic integrity of that habitat. And that's really key. When those voices drop out, it's like the string section dropping out in Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Something's missing. And it affects all the other creatures.
You know, I became an environmentalist, really, because when I was in second grade, that'd be 1967, 1968, I was 7 years old.
Yeah.
They put in a subdivision near where I lived, and the meadowlarks disappeared. And I recognized, even in second grade, I didn't have this language, but I recognized the meadowlarks are gone, and they keep building in subdivisions, the meadowlarks will have nowhere to go.
Yeah.
And so my point is that the sound of meadowlarks is what put me on the path I'm on today.
Yeah, it's really pretty. It's a gorgeous sound, whether it's eastern or western.
So, given that this culture is just grinding away at the planet, what do you want people to do regarding especially soundscapes? What can we do to help stop this destruction of the greatest symphony ever?
Well, we've got to learn to shut the hell up and pay some attention to the beauty that's around us. To me, I'm not a religious person, but to me, that soundscape, that biophony, is the voice of the divine. And it's the way that the others are reaching out to us and screaming at the top of their little lungs as much as they can to say, shut up, be quiet down, get to know us a little bit, and get to understand how important this is to your lives. And to the extent that we're able to do that, great. And to the extent we're not, I guess it's not going to work out too well. And we have and we're at that point where it's a critical decision to make.
Well, I would like to thank you very much for your work and for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Bernie Krause. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Da 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 da. Everybody thinks we're on the mother. Who are they to judge us?
Mother,
mother, simply call us sweet where I hell on
the mother.
Thanks for listening to the first hour of Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM in Acre, New York, and online at wavefarm.org. So far this evening, we've heard music from Marvin Gaye, Failure, The Flaming Lips, and Frederick Moyer playing Frederick Chopin. We heard Yellow Cedar Death Sonification by Lauren Oakes and Nick Saw, and Derek Jensen's interview with Bernie Krause, with thanks to the Progressive Radio Network at PRN-FM for permission to play excerpts. Stay tuned for a sound walk at the People's Climate March in Hudson and John Luther Adams' Become Ocean. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lojudis, signing off.